Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the former chair of the New York Film Critics Circle and National Society of Film Critics, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films Evil Does Not Exist, Taking Venice, and Scoop.
I'd like to start by talking about a movie which has got to have the most idealistic title in memory. Maybe it's the most delusional title in memory, but the movie is called Evil Does Not Exist. Oh, if only that were the case. And this is a new movie from Ryosuke Hamaguchi, Japanese filmmaker. His last film, Drive My Car, was extremely well received by a lot of people. It was a pretty good movie, I agree. I don't think it was a great masterpiece, but it was a good film. And now we have Evil Does Not Exist. And it tells a very interesting story, but it tells it at a very slow pace. This is not a movie that gallops along. It does the opposite of that. The same was with Drive My Car, actually, which again was received by a lot of people who liked it a bit better than I did. But I found it just rather sort of slow. And Evil Does Not Exist is being complained about by other people because it's slow. And I didn't actually find it all that slow. Anyway, slow cinema has been in fashion in recent years among people who love movies, and this is a good example of it. It's not extreme slow cinema, like the avant-garde kind, but it's pretty slow. So, the first person we really meet in the movie is a man named Takumi. And he lives in a fairly rural area, and at the very beginning of the film, we see him chopping wood. Okay, we see him chopping a lot of wood, chopping a piece of wood after a piece of wood after a piece of wood. And that introduces you to the pace of this movie, which is going to dwell on things. And that's fine. It's very beautifully photographed. And after a while, we meet a couple of other major characters in the film named Takahashi and Mayazumi. And these are people who have just come to the area because they work for a company that wants to set up a glamping site. Now, glamping is a term that I'm familiar with, but it's explained in the movie very clearly. It refers to glamorous camping. It's been a trend in recent years, and the idea is that you go off and you camp in the countryside, but you do it in a very comfortable and easy and perhaps glamorous way. So this company wants to set up a glamping site, and these two representatives have come to meet with the local people and get them all on board with the project so there won't be any complaints or protests or anything like that. So we see a very interesting scene of a meeting with the local citizens, and some of them are very skeptical about this. Some of them are skeptical because it will bring in too many people. Some of them are skeptical because some of those people might not be well behaved. And one person points out, and by the way, there's a lot of discussion here about the septic tank, that the septic tank, the way it's positioned, might pollute the local groundwater from which people draw water for their use, including a local restaurant that is very proud of its recipes using the local water. And as the village chief says, people are going to live downstream from where you are, and what's upstream always travels downstream. So there are debates and discussions of things like this, and the ending of the meeting with the citizens is fairly inconclusive. Then we start to discover a little bit more about the company that is setting this up. And they're not bad people. They're just concerned mainly with profits, as most companies are. And we have basically this very low-key conflict between the people who want to set up this project and the locals, who are very, many of them, very skeptical of this project. Also, Takumi, that guy who we met at the beginning of the movie, has a very young daughter. She's 8 years old. And she also becomes, for a while, a very marginal character in the film, and near the end, a very important character in the film. So as I've already said, this movie moves along very slowly. And another thing about it is that it is mysterious. It actually opens with shots of the forest nearby, and the camera moves along very slowly and sort of eerie music plays. And you get the idea here that we're just not going to be dealing with solid facts and figures and pragmatic concerns, that there's going to be more at work than that. As the movie continues, it is mainly a movie about the sort of debates and discussions between the locals and the glamping company. Also, one of the members of the glamping company decides that he'd rather side with the locals, and maybe he wants to become a person who actually looks after the glamping site once it's set up, because then he can be there and keep an eye on it and interact with the local people. So changes in personality take place. But all this builds up to the very end of the movie, which is mysterious. Suddenly the camera is very, very far away from what we're looking at. And there's a lot of mist, and it's even hard for us to make out exactly what we're supposed to be seeing here. And the little girl, that 8-year-old, is involved in this part of the movie. And the whole movie ends on what I found a very enigmatic note. It's even hard to figure out exactly what is happening or why. And that, I am sure, is the aim of the filmmaker, Ryusuke Hamaguchi. I think that he wants to demonstrate to us that these things, which seem to be very practical and pragmatic and down to earth, actually are more mysterious than that, and that we can't always predict the consequences of what we're doing, and we can't always even determine the motives or exactly what will happen or what is happening as we set about doing things in the world. That seems to me to be one of the messages of the end of the movie. In any case, if you're looking for a movie with what used to be called the Hollywood ending, where everything is tied up in a neat bow, Evil Does Not Exist gives us the exact opposite of that. Nor, by the way, I think does the title, Evil Does Not Exist, have a very strong connection with the movie that you're actually watching. I'm sure that we could draw all kinds of philosophical connections, and I've done a little thinking about this myself, but the title, the movie does not exactly illustrate why that is the title of the film. And that's another enigmatic and I think another interesting aspect of the movie. In any case, I was quite absorbed in Evil Does Not Exist. I found its slowness to be pretty justified. It's a movie that wants us to be thinking, that wants us to be contemplating, that wants us to be perhaps meditating on the themes that it raises. And maybe if we do enough of that, we won't be completely mystified by the ending. It's an unconventional movie. It's an interesting movie. And I am delighted to see it get a theatrical release in the United States. We don't get as many Japanese movies here as we used to, and this is a very, very good one. Now to turn to the day's documentary, Taking Venice. This is a movie about the Venice Biennale, the huge, important, internationally watched art show in Venice every 2 years. And this is about the Biennale way back in 1964. Now, of course, 1964 was the period of the Cold War, among other things. And art shows like the Venice Biennale were often conceived of by the people putting them on and the people participating in them as ways in which the United States could show its mastery in the world and show what a wonderful place it was and show how much extraordinary accomplishments it had in every field of human endeavor. Of course, those things still go on, but during the Cold War, those kinds of concerns were even more heightened. As it turns out, and as we discover in this documentary, Taking Venice, the United States is one of the very rare countries in the world where the government didn't support the artistic project that went on at the Biennale. All these other countries, the government was supporting the building of pavilions and the bringing in of artworks and the setting them up and all that stuff. In the United States, this was mainly private enterprise that had to pull all this off. And so that was a bit of a handicap. And it's interesting that this was going on back in 1964. It would still go on today. So what happens is that some people who are involved with the American participation in the Biennale back in 1964 decide that it's very important this year that an American win the grand prize. And they even decide what American it should be. They decide it should be Robert Rauschenberg, who is making very, very new and daring kinds of art. It's early pop art, which of course became a hugely important trend. He called a lot of his ambitious works combines, because you couldn't call them either paintings or sculptures. They were either in between or they were both. So that's what gave them a brand new name. He was, in any case, very daring, very much on the cutting edge, and therefore, of course, he was controversial. Some people felt that he was making junk, crazy, stupid assemblages that didn't really make any sense. Other people felt that he was blazing fascinating and magnificent new trails in modern art. Okay, so these people involved in the American participation in the 1964 Biennale, they include a curator named Alan Solomon, a very important art dealer in New York named Leo Castelli, some various other people, Alice Denny, by the way, who was herself an insider in Washington and very close to the Kennedy family. And remember, this is in the middle of the 1960s. They decide that they're going to get on board and somehow make sure that Robert Rauschenberg wins the grand prize. And at the end of the movie, one of the participants admits, okay, he was a very great artist, and by the way, he was, and he was doing all kinds of important things, but we engineered this, and it really does appear that way in the movie. So it's about something that happened decades ago, and it's about something that happened in the art world, but I found it just a very interesting, almost a suspense story to watch. The things they had to do along the way. For example, at the very, very last minute, when Rauschenberg is on the very verge of winning the prize, it turns out that not enough of his works were displayed in the official American pavilion. They were displayed in another place a little distance away in Venice. So that made him ineligible for the grand prize. So they had to overcome that. One of the ways they overcame that, and this was my favorite part of the movie, is they bring in the magnificent modern dancer choreographer Merce Cunningham and his troupe. Rauschenberg used to do their stage designs back in those days. So here we have Merce Cunningham and his troupe coming into Venice with music by John Cage, with design by Robert Rauschenberg performing, and it appears to have actually made a big difference in Rauschenberg finally winning the prize. So all of this kind of skullduggery and amiable kind of engineering is going on. And if you're interested in the world of art, as I sort of am, if you're interested in the world of dance and expositions and exhibitions, oh, this is the movie for you. Again, it takes place a long time ago, but the Venice Biennale is a very important institution, and this was a very important year, and Rauschenberg was a very important artist. And it's fascinating to see the kinds of things that people had to go through in order to get this guy recognized as the greatest artist in the world, at least at this moment, and how this wasn't just going to happen spontaneously. It had to be brought about by interested parties. Whether you approve of that or whether you disapprove of it, you get a very vivid picture of it in Taking Venice, a very entertaining documentary. And finally, a docudrama, Scoop, a British film directed by Philip Martin. And here we have a movie which is not a documentary, it's not showing us things as they happen, but it's based on things that really happened. And oh my gosh, it's based on a fascinating thing. It is based on an interview that Prince Andrew did back in 2019 about his relationship, his friendship, his interactions with Jeffrey Epstein, who of course very soon became a notorious sex criminal. Who in fact committed suicide in jail after he was arrested as a sex criminal, whose life was obviously doomed in terms of his how he was used to living it as a very rich and privileged and well-connected person. So what happened here? What happened here is that we had Prince Andrew, who was a friend of Jeffrey Epstein's, and somehow or other, he agrees to do an interview on the BBC, an interview on television about this. Now, the main characters of the movie, Scoop, are actually two women, Sam McAllister, played by Billy Piper, and Emily Maitlis, played by Gillian Anderson. And Sam McAllister is the one who gets the guests to go on this show, BBC Newsnight, and Emily Maitlis is the woman who ultimately does the actual on-air interview with Prince Andrew. So the question is, how are you going to get Prince Andrew to agree to this? How are you going to get the royal family, including Queen Elizabeth, to agree to this? And what's going to happen once you finally get this guy in front of the cameras, if you finally get him in front of the cameras? Well, here's a little quotation that sums it all up. One observer back at the time that this happened described the interview as a plane crashing into an oil tanker, causing a tsunami, triggering a nuclear explosion level. It was that bad for the public relations of the royal family in general and of Prince Andrew in particular. It just did not go well. He said things that were awkward. He said things that were ridiculous. He said things that were ineffectual as defenses of himself. Ah, it's really quite a story. So, Jeffrey Epstein is a very minor figure in this. I mean, he's at the center of the whole story, but we don't see much of him. And I have to say, what we do see of him is sometimes when we're seeing photographers tracking him in Prince Andrew. And that is a fascinating thing in itself, because we do get a glimpse of the paparazzi scene as it existed not that many years ago in Britain. And the lookalike they have for Jeffrey Epstein is frighteningly on target. I thought he really, really looked like Epstein. Himself. In any case, we see all of these efforts to get the story, to get Prince Andrew in front of the cameras, to get him to answer the questions. And we see all the skepticism from some people in the royal family press office and so forth. And we see how all of this ultimately comes about. And along the way, we are reminded very appropriately of the high stakes behind this whole enterprise, the things that Jeffrey Epstein obviously did, the horrors that he perpetrated, all the victims that he had. They're not the main focus of this movie, but they are always in the background. And every once in a while, the movie reminds us of how important it is to remember them as well. It's just a really done docudrama. It's not a movie for the ages. And some of this stuff came in a little bit in that wonderful recent series, a TV series, The Crown. But Prince Andrew is a fascinating character as portrayed in this movie by Rufus Sewell, by the way, who does a nice job. And the story itself is simply fascinating. So if you're interested in television, if you're interested in the royal family, if you're interested in horrific crimes of recent years, then have a look at Scoop. I had a really good time watching it, despite the horrific nature of the background facts. And that is my somewhat fictional, somewhat non-fictional story this week.
For which we thank you as ever and always, David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films Evil Does Not Exist, Taking Venice, and Scoop.
Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.